Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Victory Degree Podcast. There are plenty of podcasts out there, and so I thank you for choosing the Victory Degree today. The podcast where my mission is to interview the most influential people in sports, both on and off the field. Today's guest is Dr. Jim Lehrer, a world-renowned performance psychologist, New York Times bestselling author, co-founder, and coach. Dr. Lehrer has worked with hundreds of world-class performers from the arenas of sport, business, medicine, and law enforcement, including Fortune 100 executives, FBI hostage rescue teams, and military special forces. Dr. Lehrer's sports clients include 17 number ones in the world in their respective sports, multiple clients from professional tennis, golf, basketball, football, hockey, boxing, race car driving, and the Olympics. He has applied his methodology to both individuals and entire teams. From his more than 30 years of experience and applied research, Dr. Lehrer believes the single most important factor in successful achievement, personal fulfillment, and life satisfaction is the strength of one's character. Dr. Jim Lehrer is a world-renowned performance psychologist whose groundbreaking, science-based energy management training system has achieved worldwide recognition. Dr. Lehrer has been chronicled in leading national publications, including Fortune, Harvard Business Review, U.S. News Report, and has been featured on NBC's Today Show and the Oprah Winfrey Show. In this interview, Dr. Lehrer reveals his journey to sports psychology, what mental toughness is and how to increase it, how the best tennis players in the world stay mentally tough during a match, the power of your inner voice and how to harness it to achieve greatness, how to build up your resiliency, the idea of an ideal performance state, and much more. As always, I sincerely hope you enjoy this episode. And if you do, please consider leaving a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find this episode. It helps the show more than you know. With that, let's get to the episode. Welcome to the Victory Degree Podcast.
Thank you, Nick. I'm excited to join you, and I really do hope we can cover some ground that really is interesting and intriguing to your audience.
Well, then, let's start with a quote that you have at the beginning of your book that I actually just finished reading today, The New Toughness Training for Sports. Excellent read, one of your older works, but it has stood the test of time, and a lot of the concepts that you cover in the book are still very relevant today, even perhaps more relevant than they were back when the book was released in the 90s. But one of the quotes that you have at the very, very beginning of your book, you say, you know, this book is for my mother and father. But then you also say, for the gift of sport that has added so much richness and dimension to my life. So I figured a good place for us to start is this gift of sport and what it has offered you the ability to do throughout your career.
You know, I've had this love affair with competitive athletics, and it has given me so many opportunities. My entire career, I started out in mental health. I got my doctorate and master's in psychology, specializing in mental health. But I really was so taken with this notion that psychology could be applied to human performance. That was introduced to me by a brilliant exercise physiologist way back in the late 70s. Dr. Joe Vigil, and he's an Olympic legend. And he got my mind working in that direction. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to join the two things I love most, psychology and sport. And my father was an avid sportsman. He was basically a professional baseball player. He was a tennis player. He was nuts about sports. And he got his two sons. involved in sport. He was my coach, baseball coach, for 9 years. I got involved in tennis. I played at a pretty high level in basketball. Sport was a gift when I was a young boy. And my basketball coach, who is now no longer with us, Joe Gibbs, played a pivotal role in my life. He came into my life. He believed in me at a time when I really needed that kind of confidence and someone to invest in me. And I mention him in many of my books, the power a coach has to transform a person's life. And so my entire career has been around basically for 40 years, helping high-level performers in just about every high-stress arena try to fulfill whatever talent and skill they possess in the crucible of extreme environments oftentimes. And I just feel like sport is a gift to anyone who really understands what sport is about. It's an opportunity to test your mettle when the consequences are not usually so deadly or so costly. And in life, as you get older, you don't have those opportunities. But a lot of the skills I have to thank my father and all my coaches who helped me navigate through sport and gave me the opportunity to learn these skills that have proven invaluable in all of my life endeavors.
You talk about marrying the schools of psychology and sport, and that culminated in your first book, Toughness Training for Sports, which I believe was released in 1979. Correct me if I'm wrong. But what was the state of sports psychology back then? What was some of the work that was happening in that field?
So it's really, it's kind of an interesting story. My love for psychology and sports started to take form, and I started my entire career with a research project that took me 2 years. I interviewed 21 high-level athletes and asked them to tell me what they were feeling. What were the words that came to the surface when they were describing their key peak moments of competition? And I was assuming it was different for all these different sports. And what I came to understand, didn't matter whether it was a lineman in football or someone who was, a quarterback where they have a very different responsibility, basketball, track and field. I was in, even boxers. I had some boxers in this sample. And they all describe basically a similar internal climate that I came to refer to as one's ideal performance state. There's a very special place you go that ignites all this talent and skill within you. And it's very, very delicate. And it's really a biochemical, psychophysiological state that can be trained, but it takes a lot of hard work. And you'll never get it perfectly because it's too fragile. But the best figure out how to do that. And so I wrote a book, and it was my first publication was in 1978 called Athletic Excellence, Mental Toughness Training for Sport. I sent it around to 19 publishers and got rejected by all 19. And the response almost universally was, what the heck is mental toughness? We never heard of that before. And we don't believe there's any audience for it. And my dad said, I'm an athlete and I really like what you've written. I'm going to have a few copies printed and we'll send it around to a bunch of athletes that I know and coaches and maybe national governing bodies. And just to see what people think. And we did that. And that really began my career. It started rolling in. And then I think it was 1979, it was picked up by Penguin and became a world bestseller, international bestseller. And so that was the beginning. And it really started with a very simple research project that took a lot of work, but really helped me understand how the mind and body work in the crucible of stress.
A lot to unpack there. I certainly want to get to the IPS and this, you know, I've heard the term flow state. I've heard other athletes describe it as this flow state, very similar to what you're describing with this ideal performance state. So certainly want to go down that rabbit hole. But as you take yourself back to the 70s and even the early 80s, when you were starting your work and this idea of mental toughness and this idea of sports psychology was kind of coming together, what are some athletes that come to mind? I'm curious from that time that maybe would have benefited from your research or the knowledge that, you know, you had to give to others. You know, what athletes come to mind would benefit from some of that knowledge?
Well, you know, it's so interesting that I had nowhere to go. I started my practice in Denver, and I realized I didn't know anything. And so I had to, and there was no place to go to learn. I couldn't get a master's or doctorate, and I could not find a single person in private practice specializing in the application of psychology to human performance. It just wasn't there. So I said, you know, I need to learn. What am I doing setting up a practice? And I really don't have a clue. That's why I did that 2-year project. And then in tennis, and I've always been an avid tennis player, Jimmy Connors was one of the most dominant competitors at that time. And I thought, you know, I'd love to spend some time and study how his brain works. How does it work for him? And just by chance, they were opening up a new center in Sanibel Harbor, just south of Fort Myers, called the Jimmy Connors United States Tennis Center. And a guy by the name of Bob Davis was looking for someone to run that whole facility. So I got a hold of Bob and I said, listen, I'll run the whole operation, all the sports and everything else, the tennis, but I want to have access to Jimmy Connors' brain. I want to know how does it work? And he said, oh, that should be no problem. So I was there for 2 years, and he never told Jimmy Connors, he said. So, you know, I was videoing Jimmy. I was out there. He's going, who the hell is this Lair guy? And Bob Davis would say, no, he's run this operation, and I made the agreement that, you know, the two of you would spend some time. You could come to understand, Jim could, a lot about how your brain works. And so I eventually came to this understanding that if everyone had to be like Jimmy, you know, it's going to be a hard time. He's a very unique individual. And up the road in Bradenton was the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And I had many of their students coming down to the Jimmy Connors United States Tennis Center. Nick would send them down there, and he didn't like it. He didn't like them traveling. And so at the end of the 2 years, he said, listen, why don't you come here, set up your institute. I will give you access in whatever way you want. You'll be director of sports science and sports psychology for the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy, and we'll do great things together. And so there was Andre Agassi, Jim Courier, David Wheaton, Martin Blackman, Mark Knowles, Monica Salas. We had one of the most amazing collections of superstar potentials that tennis probably has ever known in one place. And I was there for 6 years. I collected more data. I still have boxes of data. I'm a data guy. I love to collect data and see how trends and data trends and so forth. And that was worth 2 PhDs for me, because that's where I learned everything. And then I joined forces with Dr. Jack Groppel, who had his PhD in bioengineering, and we set up the Human Performance Institute, where we had some 250 to 300,000 people. Jim Courier trained there when he was number one, Pete Sampras. But we had 17 number ones in the world trained there, including Army Special Forces and Navy SEALs and all kinds of high-stress applications. But it was really the work that I had the opportunity. I'm so grateful for the time I spent at NICS, where I could learn from all these players who are in the midst of this competitive, almost nightmare that they were in on the grounds, fighting one another tooth and nail, preparing themselves for the tour. And so that was how I got started. And it was kind of a convoluted way.
I'm curious. So I also a huge tennis fan. I've been watching it for a while. I have to say I'm a big Djokovic fan. A lot of that has to do with our shared Serbian heritage.
Fantastic.
So big Novak fan. But I've always been curious because I'll see, you know, I'll watch Novak and he's over the years developed almost this, you know, this habit of letting frustration and what's happening on the court sometimes get the best of him. And, you know, oftentimes that culminates in either him smashing a racket or having an outburst, or a lot of times it's him yelling at his team. I've certainly seen that a fair amount of times. And I've always been curious what the struggles that they go through are on the court. And I'm curious from your experience working with some of the tennis players that you mentioned at the Nick Molitori Tennis Academy, and then also leading into your work at the Human Performance Institute, and then also just studying some of, you know, today's tennis players. If you could provide some insight on what are some of the struggles that they go through on the court, and maybe what are some of the things that they're telling themselves or maybe not telling themselves, kind of what that mind game is with their own mind.
So again, when I was at the Molitori Academy, I had access to all the players. And so I used a lot of video and a lot of telemetry. And we cataloged every single thing. One of the things that was a great breakthrough for me that I think had never been looked at before was the between point time in tennis. And everyone was always watching how they performed. And then I thought it would be interesting if I only showed people the during point time, which is only maybe 30% of a match, would they be able to tell who is the mentally toughest, who are the best competitors? And most couldn't tell anything. But when I showed the between point time, everything just became obvious to everyone that all the emotions, the fears, the anxieties, the negativity, their sense of confidence in themselves became evident in this time when they were not hitting balls. And so I started cataloging what the best players, the 10 best players in the world, were doing between points, and developed a training system called the 16-second cure. Steffi Graf took the least amount of time between points and still was able to perform well at a very extraordinarily high level. And so I called it the 16-second. You needed to take at least 16 seconds and you need to ritualize it. And I broke it into four phases that players can go through. And I started with all the early players and then we just redid that with all the modern players, and we found exactly the same thing. And you can get that on my website. It's free to everybody, but it's I think it's one of the most important things I actually did in my career for sport, because we did it in professional hockey, we did it in other sports, where we try to help people understand how to recover in whatever time you have at a very, very high level. And so when you watch Novak, you know, kind of go off the deep end, and if you're really very, very carefully monitoring his physiology, it means that, you know, his ability to trigger his ideal performance state in that wild show of emotion, the frustration, the anger, and, you know, he is the GOAT. He's the greatest player ever to have played, no question. But he also struggles with his competitiveness, and now that he's a little older in age. He can't, you know, he has children and everything else. It's hard for him to make this the most important thing in his life. So he understandably gets upset when he doesn't reach his expectations and knows what he really can and should do. And we have some players now that are so remarkable that have learned this, and how they learned it exactly, I'm not sure, whether they've had coaches who really helped them, like Yannick Sinner. Sinner is, if you watch his between point time and the way in which he manages the stress of match play, I don't know that there's anyone that I've ever seen does it better. He's balanced, he's healthy. He even can laugh between points when things kind of get out, even though it's a critical moment. The same thing is true with Carlos Alcaraz. He has an amazing ability to stay pretty much in the present. He was mentored by Rafa Nadal, and they all very closely studied the work of, you know, people like Roger Federer, who was almost the master of all of this. And there, in the men's game, there are more and more players who now are really exhibiting this brilliance of, to handle their emotions, to stay calm, to stay focused, and to access their genius, whether it's Demonar or whether it's Hurkacz or, and in the women's game, there are so many. Iga Swiatek is an amazing example of focus, intensity, calmness, her ability to reset in adversity. There's so many great examples of people on both sides of the aisle there that are really understanding what it took us years and years and years of study around this understanding of what has to bubble up inside you in order to play at your best. And how do you use the between point time, which can be as much as 70% of a match, to your advantage, to your competitive advantage. And, you know, I've spent so much of my career studying this notion of your inner coach, which is the most important coach you will ever have in your life. More important than any coach that anyone has in the stands or working with you off court is the advice and the kind of just the way in which your inner voice is coaching you. The tone and the content can make the entire difference in terms of whether or not you achieve your potential, you handle the stress, and that voice needs to be trained. I call it IV2, inner voice 2, where you actually train that voice to be a trusted advisor above any other voice that you might hear. And so that has been another part of my career that I have. It's intoxicating for me to learn some of this. And when I learn it, I just try to share it in the hope it might make sense to others as well.
You talk about the inner voice. There's a clip on YouTube of Jim Courier saying that probably the most important thing that he learned from you was the how to manage the between the points and that time. And I think he mentioned resetting as something that you taught him as well. When I hear all these things, inner voice, inner coach, you know, resetting, all these things that we could potentially take from athletes, you know, we're talking about tennis athletes now specifically, but on a broader scale, any athlete really, what are some things that people, you know, can take away and should take away from some of the things that you've learned from these athletes and what you've been able to teach them that they can implement starting tomorrow?
I really think that we need to frame competitive athletics in the right way. And that is that this is simply a learning environment to hone skills through competitive athletics that will help you become a more fully functioning, stronger adult in life, in every part of your life outside of sport. So if sport is an end in itself and you really have to do everything and make it happen there, you know, you're not going to compete but just a few years. And if you develop assets or skill sets that actually don't really facilitate or enhance your life after sport can be a tragedy. And so I've worked so hard to try to translate to athletes what they're learning in the crucible of competitive athletics that can help them become a better, healthier human being, both during sport and after sport. And this the inner voice. If you get that voice right in sport, you can carry that for the rest of your life. And one of the things we've learned in our data collection is that the way in which you speak to your children will one day become their inner voice. And so the tone and content that you are now as an adult coming across with your own children, is that how you want them to speak to themselves? That'll be the only voice that's in their head until their death. And so we're really working to help people understand the power of one's inner voice. That's the master storyteller. That's the master of your destiny, is that voice that is, you know, really starts forming as early as 5 years of age. And, you know, I've written a couple of books on it. And it is one of the most exciting areas for people to try to, you know, try to get a better understanding of the power of one's inner voice and how this can actually be almost look like it's coded in the genes because it occurs from generation to generation. But those parents are speaking to their children. You know, if you say to your children and motivate them, you know, I don't know what the heck's the matter with you. If I'd have had your opportunities, I would have been a superstar. We've done everything for you. You do nothing. You're a loser. And you think that's going to motivate them. And what that does is it goes in and that voice picks up on that. And the brain can't really purge it. It's like one of those things that just keeps popping up. Every time you don't do well, you remember that voice. You're a loser. You're never going to amount to anything. If I'd have had your opportunities, I would have done so much more. I regret having put this much energy into you. And they do it to really get them off the center line so that they actually do more with their life. But it actually has the opposite effect in many cases.
So what would be step one in, first of all, identifying what this inner voice might be telling you? Because I think as I'm sitting here, you know, thinking about what you're saying, I'm almost trying to listen to my own inner voice as I'm listening to you and trying to decipher, okay, right now in this present moment, as I'm sitting here on this podcast recording with you, what is my inner voice telling me? Is my inner voice telling me, hey, you know, Nick, you're doing a great job. You can do this. Keep pushing forward. Is my inner voice telling me you suck? You're not going to amount to anything. This is the worst podcast of all time. Dr. Lair is probably bored with your questions. You know, what is my inner voice trying to tell me here? So I guess step one, how do we actually identify what our inner voice is saying to us? And then what would be, you know, the approach to tackling perhaps how to change that inner voice?
So at the Nick Baldieri Tennis Academy, one of the things I did was I put microphones on all the players. And there was a recorder that recorded everything that they were saying to themselves, they were to say out loud, and it was picked up by a recorder. So we were making their private voice public, and so they could become very, very aware of it. And then we took that taped messaging and we went into editing it all the way down. So we got just what you said all the way, maybe down into 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And so we would set it up like this. We'd say, okay, you're in a very tough competitive battle. Here's what you said to yourself to help you along the way. And a lot of the language was unimaginably negative. You idiot. What's the matter with you? I hate you. Hate my forehand. My backhand sucks. I can't stand this idiot. I'm playing. He's a bloody cheater. All the stuff that was going through their head, they had to make vocal. And then I would ask them, is this the best coaching advice you could possibly give? Because your brain hears it all, whether it's private or public, your brain is listening. It's always on. And so then they had to write out a script that this is kind of how they would like to see if they were coaching their best friend in the same situation and really wanted them to do well, what would you say to them? So we began to change the way in which they related to themselves. They were coaching their best friend. And ultimately, I wanted them to feel comfortable if whatever they were saying to themselves were projected up onto a jumbotron so everyone could see it. Everyone. Would they be proud of the messaging and the tone that they sent? And if they're not happy, then we need to continue to work. And so you're right, Nick, that the first step, that was what we did with them, was to increase your awareness of the tone and the content and how proud are you of the way in which you coach yourself. Is this a voice that you can trust? And is it really something that you would want, let's say, in the head of someone that you deeply cared about? And what happens is you begin to realize that maybe you have a very critical inner voice. It's like, and that often comes from parents who actually didn't realize it, but were trying to help motivate you, or coaches in your life who were maybe the screamer kind, who are always jumping your bones for never living up. And all of a sudden now, that's how you speak to yourself. And so we have people train their inner voice with their hand by writing. So I would have, like Dan Jansen had a journal every day. And all the players we worked with had to keep journals. And I wanted them to take every conceivable situation in a competitive arena and to rehearse how they wanted to coach themselves, the tone and the content that they would feel would be the best advice they could possibly give. So it might be something as simple, calm down, you're too negative. Stay in the moment, you're worried about the outcome too much here. Take a deep breath, go through your pre-performance rituals between points or between, any kind of, whether it's batting in baseball or you have in hockey, when you have opportunities to really just check out for a moment, what would you like to have as the best advice you could give? And so that awareness, and with your hand, every day they do journaling. And it's not a gripe. They don't write, about all the things they're upset about. They only have the very best that they could possibly give to themselves. And we found that reading that before a competitive event and doing it over and over again, the brain begins to understand. You're teaching it how you want it to function in high-stress environments. And all of a sudden, you never can cut out really the bad stuff, but you can actually keep reinforcing the way in which your inner voice is operating at the highest level, and eventually becomes better. Occasionally you will lose it with a really bad situation, or you haven't eaten properly, or you've been stressed out, and you kind of lose it, and that's what happens with people like Novak or anyone else. But you want to get to the point where that is something you can control, and you want to work during competition on the things you can control, your attitude, your effort, and your inner voice coaching. And let the rest go, because there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to ride the waves and really try to be as positive, resilient, and reset as much as possible when things don't go your way. But that is it's a very hard lesson, because people somehow think that if you're tough on yourself, you're going to raise your game. Well, when you do get really negative, what happens with your physiology is that these adrenal cortical hormones start to rise. One of the most powerful is cortisol. And when cortisol levels rise, muscles get tighter, the oscillation frequency of your brain starts to increase, you lose your ability to have perspective, and there's all kinds of physiological ramifications, almost all of which don't help you. There's a certain level of cortisol that is important, but if you get past this ideal level, nothing works right. And this is when athletes get so upset, and because they know what they can do and they can't do it in the moment, maybe that it really is so important.
One more question on this topic of the inner voice. Why should people care? And you mentioned you were a big data person. I am an engineer by trade, so I too enjoy data and crunching numbers. I'm almost trying to figure out a way if there's a method of quantifying how big of a difference this inner voice has in reaching one's potential. So it's almost like if you have, hey, this is what your potential could be if your inner voice was trained to be positive, to be uplifting, to be almost like a best friend, right? When you think about the advice that you give maybe your best friend and then the advice that you give yourself, for a lot of people, that's vastly different. One is a lot more positive than the other. So you have that potential where it's like, okay, if your inner voice was a certain way, but then you have where you're currently at because your inner voice is negative, and it's been that way for a while. So could you help me understand what that difference in potential is?
All I can say is I've been immersed in this for 40 years. And my only objective is to help people reach their full potential. Nothing in my training as a psychologist led me to the importance of this inner voice. It all came from all the endless hours I had working with athletes. And I've traveled with athletes all over the world and tried to understand. We actually have done things like, video. I love videotape because it's an actual record of what's going on. And then ask them, what do you think they're thinking? What are they saying to themselves here? And is it really helping them? And what do you believe might be the most important message you could give yourself here? And the more you do that, the more I realize that, hey, wait a minute, if I get too far off the grid with, I'm trying to control this delicate physiological biochemical balance in my body. And if I go completely off the grid, I'm probably disturbing that, in a way that's going to be very hard to get it back. Maybe if I crush a racket here or there, or I scream and yell, or I trash talk my opponent occasionally, that might end up clearing house and you reset and you play better. But I can tell you, if that was my experience, I'd be teaching that. And my experience has been exactly the opposite. When I watch Yannick Sinner perform, I get goosebumps. Goosebumps not just because of his athletic genius, but because of the way in which he connects with himself. He's a very healthy, very balanced person in terms of his understanding what all this means. He feels very grateful for the opportunity. He has the ability to reset quickly after maybe a couple really bad points. He's very humble, but he has the sense that I am going to get better every single day. And if I don't do as well today, I will figure it out and get better. He has what I call kind of a beginner's mindset. He's always looking to find another opportunity. Darren Cahill, his coach, and Ricardo Piatti, who was his original coach, really helped him to understand how important balance is and be a person who's understands what excellence really means at the highest level. And it's as much between your ears as it is biomechanically, as it is with your diet, your nutrition. And so I have great respect. And then if you look at all the great past champions, in the men's and women's game, when you look at Rafa, he was able to the greatest clay court player in the history, and before him, Borg, their ability to handle this emotional side of the game, to stay positive, not to be overly upset. And they all, everyone has this competitive drive. Even someone like Boris Becker or someone like Federer, you think, well, they didn't have that temper. They had wild tempers, and they had to learn how to tame the lion without putting out the fire. They had to learn how, you know, Borg had to have his rackets taken away. And if he didn't control himself, he wasn't allowed to play. Well, he finally learned. And when he did, it escalated him to a level that no one really understood could even be achieved at that time. The same with Federer, same with Rafa. And everyone is struggling. That's probably the ultimate contest, is the contest of you against yourself. And if you're fighting yourself, you have two opponents. You have your opponent on the other side, and then you have, you know, your fight with yourself. I had the opportunity to work with Ray Boom Boom Mancini in his title fight with Hector Macho Camacho. And I was in Vegas with him. I was in his corner during that fight and spent a lot of time with Ray. And, you know, he was the most positive human being. He was an amazing, amazing competitor. And I asked him, I said, how do you stay so positive? You just get bloodied in your training routines and everything else. You're getting hit. How do you do it? He said, Jim, when you finally realize that every negative thought usually means you're going to get hit in the face, that he said, how much would other sports change? Have you ever seen a negative fighter in the ring? Have you ever seen a bullfighter? And I flew all the way to Spain to interview one of Spain's most famous bullfighters, Martin Vazquez. He has passed away. But I asked him, how do you control this fear? And he said, it's with the language of my body. If you've ever seen a bullfighter show anything but supreme confidence, and they train that, and they train within themselves this inner voice. And so if every time we had a negative thought in a sport like tennis, you got hit in the face, you'd clean your act up in a hurry. And those are the lessons that took me years to fully understand. But negativity means you're vulnerable. And you need to face the truth, and you need to reset and come back with belief in yourself, and you need to fight like a dog. But you cannot just come out and just use brute strength in most sports as an act of aggression to get out your frustration and really find, you know, the gold you're looking for. It's not how it works.
Going back to your Federer point that you made earlier, it reminded me, I recently read his the biography that was done on him by Christopher Clary, which yes. I highly recommend. Excellent book. But one of the things I didn't realize was how emotional Federer was growing up as a kid playing tennis and how much work it took him to control his emotions. And I mean, there's passages in the book that detail Federer crying, you know, after matches, staying on the court, crying, not wanting to leave because he was so distraught that he had lost, showing emotion on the court. And it was so interesting to me because obviously growing up, you know, watching Federer, he was such a calming presence on the court. I mean, I can remember one, maybe two outbursts that he's ever had where you could really tell that he was frustrated or angry. I remember one time that I remember that he smashed his racket. I think it was against Novak, actually. He was missing his forehand the entire afternoon. And I think by the third set, he had had enough. And I think he smashed his racket. And even now, when I think of that, I'm like, man, like Federer, like that was Federer, like Federer did that, like that he smashed his racket. So it was interesting to see that even Federer struggled with that early on.
I think everyone should read that book and realize that almost every competitor in sport, when you put a lot of heat in the chamber, when you're competitive, you have to figure out how to contain those forces in a constructive way. If you don't, you're never going to make it. And if you don't have the fire in your belly, then it's easy not to care that much. You don't put that much in there. But it's a very delicate mix, and it takes years to learn that. And parents play a pivotal role. If parents allow their kids to show all the negative emotions and to attack them or to speak badly about them in front of all their, during competition. And the thing about tennis is you're on display. There's no place to hide. There's no timeouts. And so everything you do is on full display. And you really have to really admire the extraordinary control that this game requires. And it's never ending. And it's all trying to control that delicate inner balance. And occasionally you lose it. But if you get to the point where that becomes a skill set, one of your primary competencies, then you're going to be able to play toward the upper range of your talent and skill. Whether you win or lose, it really more depends on how much you're able to bring of what you have to the table. And that's where this emotional control and this mental control are so critical. And it's been for me just a fascinating journey to learn the delicate things that can make a difference in a person's ability to pull the trigger at critical moments. And then because of our work with military, there's a lot more to when it's truly life and death and like a bullfighter, if they choke, they're going to get gored, maybe killed. And if in golf, every time you hit a bad shot, you had the potential of dying or someone dying, golf would change in a nanosecond. And so, but we can learn from sports that have such a godforsaken endpoint if you don't get it right as a pilot, as a SEAL Team 6 leader going into a very hostile environment. You have to get it right. And if you don't, not only is your own life in jeopardy, but all the men you are, or all the men and women you are leading, can be in harm's way. And that'll be on your shoulders for the rest of your life. So, those life and death venues have taught me a great deal as well. And I feel very fortunate to have had both, because sport is just a game, but there are a lot of things that are far more than a game, and they can help us understand kind of what we have to do to bring our best forward always when it counts.
Dr. Lehr, I want to take us down a path, and that path involves a man by the name of Dan Jansen, who was a guest of this podcast about 3 to 4 months ago. If you don't know the story of Dan Jansen, I highly suggest you either check out the podcast that I did with him. He's been on numerous other ones. If you just search his name, there are numerous articles and videos that come up on Dan Jansen. Truly, and not just saying this, this is said by many other people, including Dr. Lehr, one of the most remarkable sports stories you will ever hear, one of the most remarkable stories of resilience, of success when nobody thought he could succeed, just a truly, truly remarkable story. And it was interesting to me, Dr. Lehr, because when I had Dan on, we ended up talking about what it means to find success and what does it mean to be successful. And I thought he was a good person to ask because he had been chasing a goal for so long that eluded him for many, many years. And that was to capture the Olympic gold. And so it was interesting because, and this is a quote from our podcast, he said, "Even if I hadn't won gold, I know that I could look back today and say, I worked as hard as I could work to be as good as I can be. And that's all that really matters. That's really all any coach should ask of you, because in the end, there's generally one person on top of the podium or one Super Bowl winner. And so the win is not the most important thing." I'm curious, as you compare that quote and present day Dan Jansen and the work that you did with Dan before he won Olympic gold, how does that quote compare to the Dan back then?
Well, I really feel like that quote from Dan is right on the money. I think it's really what it's all about. And for me, to put it simply, is more important than what you achieve is who you became as a person as a consequence of the chase. A lot of my work with Dan was to make him understand that who he was as a person was far more important than how many Olympic medals that he would win. That he had to do everything possible, and then he could rest knowing that he did the best that he could to be the best that he could be. And then you can live with that, so that there's no remorse that I should have done this or should have. You turn as many leaves over as humanly possible. So, you know, that is the perspective I try to have with every athlete that I have the opportunity to work with, is that it's the person first and the athlete second. And life throws some unbelievable curveballs at people, as it did with Dan. In the death of his sister on the very day of the most important day of his career, when he was supposed to win the 500, his sister Jane, 3 hours before, had died of leukemia, and he wasn't even sure that he should skate. And his dad was there in Calgary, and his dad asked him, "What do you think Jane would want you to do?" And Dan was mortified that he wasn't by her side when she passed. He would have left in an immediate instance if he'd have thought she was in any way in danger of dying. But it just happened. And he responded, "I think she would want me to skate." So he tried to put his skates on. He was in tears. And 10 meters into the race, which he never fell in those situations, he fell hopelessly to the ice. And that began the story of Dan Jansen. And I do believe I've been involved and have read and been in touch with so many people that have had incredible stories. I think Dan Jansen's story is one of the greatest stories in sports history. And it was because of what he faced and what he was up against, and how he was able to rise up in the last race of his life and go against what everyone thought was impossible, that he had 7 people who had faster times than he had ever had in the same event, the 1,000-meter race, that he had come in Albertville 26th 2 years earlier. No one gave him a chance. Not only did he win an Olympic gold medal, but he broke an Olympic record in the process. And that was against all odds in the final race of his Olympic career.
What should people take away from Dan's story?
I think it's the notion that, you know, if you do everything you can, you know, one of the things that I've always, and I didn't really have this as a psychologist, I didn't really get into the space. It was nothing that I thought was something that was going to be a big part of my career later on. And it was something I talk about, character. And character, for me, the most important part of character is moral character, the way you treat other people. And Dan's treatment of others, he has this, you know, he's very sensitive. It comes from an unbelievably wonderful, caring family. But his concern for others, his kindness, his perspective, his humility, even though he was the best of the best in the 500 meter, and he broke the world record in the 500 meter, he won so many World Cups and everything else. He was just a guy that just was doing something that he loved. And my message to him was, if you don't win any Olympic medal at all, what do you think about all this time you've spent with speed skating? And he thought about it for a moment. He says, it's been the greatest gift I think I've ever been given. And I said, that is what the conclusion should be, is that you have grown, you become an extraordinary human being as a result of it. And if you win an Olympic medal, and if you were to win an Olympic gold medal, this would just be icing on the cake. And so I got into the character space, and Dan Jansen has a really wonderful, remarkable character. When we were down in the bowels of Lillehammer's big stadium there, and he had lost the 500, and all of his competitors came up to him, and Dan was in tears. And I was there. I flew in. I didn't want him to know I was in the audience because I thought it might put more pressure on him. But I hid. And when he didn't win in the 500, I had to fight through security. And I saw Dan and I was screaming and yelling. And I said, Dan, it's Jim. And he goes, oh my God, let him through. And we went down into the deepest chambers of the Lillehammer facility, and the respect that all these competitors showed him. Many of them were in tears and said, listen, this should be yours, man. You are the best of the best. This is not the way it should have ended. Of course, I had tears in my eyes as well, but we had 4 days, and that's why I was there, just in case he didn't win the 500, which he was really supposed to. We still had 4 days to win the 1,000, which was a long shot, but he did it. So, but people love being around him. He's just the kind of person you just have a deep appreciation for, and it's because of his treatment of other people on the way to the top.
One thing I think of when I think of Dan's story is how big of a national story it became. I mean, it was, you know, I forget the exact phrases that they had for Dan, but, you know, it was, you know, choker from the United States or along those lines. I forget the exact names that they had come up for him, but it was a national story at the time. And I think of now with some of the things that the athletes need to deal with that maybe they haven't had to deal with in the past. And one thing that immediately comes to mind is social media and how that's changed the landscape and how that's maybe added additional pressure to athletes. I'm curious from your perspective how these struggles have evolved throughout the years and how maybe social media has been a part of that.
You know, everyone has struggles, and they're inevitable. And, you know, so much of your ability to have a great life depends on your ability to find a way around, through, or over the obstacles that you face. And that's what I really believe sport is such a wonderful opportunity to really get a lot of those skill sets honed in. And even at your highest level, I mean, just in the last week, I have athletes who have just experienced some things that you can't even imagine, horrific things, and they are the very best in the world. No one even knows that it's happening to them. But they have to somehow contain them. They have to figure out, or it will bleed over into every part of their life as an athlete and as a person. And so we often look at athletes and think, God, they have a perfect life. But when you get inside of their lives, they have so many things they're dealing with, whether it be with family or with autoimmune disorders or all kinds of health complications, food and diet issues, chronic issues with shoulders, or even arthritis issues that show up they can't imagine, autoimmune issues. And no one even knows any of this is going on, and they don't want anyone to know. But this is all part of what they have to face, just like we have to face all of those things in our lives. But we tend to think that athletes have the perfect path to just the greatest life ever. And I've not met many people, and I have been around a lot of superstars, And that's not the trail that most people have to follow. So that's why I love to see little whippersnappers in sport working it out, having problems, get, you know, have a little injury in their finger and they can't play or can't throw the ball. They ended up getting headed or somebody took them down and they're out for a few weeks. Now they're in rehab. They have to have their knee rehab. All of this is really, this is what life is, you know, and this is just a microcosm that doesn't really matter to help you understand how to be more resilient. Resilience is probably the most important competency we have outside of just good decision making. And resiliency involves decision making. What are you going to do now that you've been kicked in the face and you've lost miserably to someone you shouldn't even have even come close to losing to, and all your fans are walking away? What are you going to do now? And that is why this arena of competitive sport is so valuable, because it's going to be with you in some form, adversity and crisis, until your last breath. And if you don't get that inner voice coaching you properly, you are in serious trouble, because it's never going to be a straight, easy path to all the good times.
How do we build up resiliency? How do we become more resilient?
Well, it is a competency, and tennis is just about resiliency, being able to bounce back from terrible shot and, you know, your opponent treeing and getting into unbelievable shot making that you've never seen before, and or taking hits from the press that are just so unfair. But if you don't show up for your press conferences, you know you're going to get obliterated because it didn't look like you were trying that hard, but you're sick, you have a temperature, you had to show up. If you didn't, you would have probably been fined and everyone would have been down your throat. And so each of these things represents another challenge that you've got to decide. Am I going to take it or am I going to leverage this to become stronger as a person? Every day things happen. Bad things happen in one form or another. And you've got to decide, do I just live with that, or can I leverage this in a way that actually will help me to have a better life and to be a person who just doesn't live for the good moments, but actually leverages the tough times, the storms, to become, you know, a little bit better tomorrow. And if you do that over and over again, you get very good at it. And you can end up as a competitor in sport that people admire. You're a tremendous inspiration. But on the most deeply personal level, you're a great inspiration for others, because you can take that cancer diagnosis. You can go in when your kids end up and have a godforsaken, you know, problem in school that they really don't have any idea how they're going to deal with. And rather than just falling down and just saying the world is against me, you find a way to rally some resources and come up with something that actually converts this and makes you stronger at the end of the day, as opposed to making you weaker. And that is a skill we can practice every single day.
Love it. Dr. Lehrer, as we wrap up this conversation, I promised the audience that we would talk about the IPS, the ideal performance state. And so I figured we could spend a couple minutes, or you could perhaps spend a couple minutes explaining what IPS is and how to achieve it.
So the ideal performance state is simply a very special mind-body state of balance that produces an underlying chemistry that enables you to be the best you can be in that moment. All kinds of things can affect that. Whether, you know, if you have reached a point of fatigue, you don't have the oxygen transport efficiency, and your lungs just can't deliver enough oxygen, it's going to compromise that special balance. If blood sugar levels get too low, and all of a sudden your neurons and your brain are gluttons for glucose and oxygen, you start bonking. And people think you're just not that mentally tough, but it actually, the biggest insight I have that mental toughness is not just mental. It's physical, it's emotional, it's mental, and it's actually character driven. And that was the last piece in my career. But, you know, the words, the descriptors that people continue to come up with, I felt very calm inside, emotionally calm. I felt, you know, very physically relaxed. My muscles felt very loose and free. I was able to pretty much focus my attention on the here and now. I wasn't worried about the outcome as much as I could just get into this bubble of concentration. It was almost effortless. It didn't seem like I was trying that hard, even though I was giving the best effort I could. I had an overwhelmingly positive sense of what was going on. I had a positive attitude, and my confidence somehow seemed to be, I didn't have super confidence, but I felt like I could handle what was going on in this moment. It wasn't beyond me. So as these descriptors kept coming up, what I realized was that this was simply a language that was describing this internal state of biochemical balance. And anything can affect it. If you are deeply disappointed with the stupid numbskull shot you just made, chances are there's going to be a spike in the emotional quotient that may not or may interfere with this very delicate balance. And what you say to yourself or how you can reset quickly after someone calls you a name from the crowd. I was watching center the other day. I don't know what was called out, but it was a very critical point in this match. And he catches the ball on his serve and starts laughing. And he's laughing at a critical point, and he's going, I don't know what the situation was that caused it, but I thought, how remarkable is it in this moment of high stress, he actually found some humor in the moment. And then he bounces the ball, and the chair umpire settles the crowd down, and he throws the ball up again, and he breaks into almost hysterical laughter. He all has to bend over because he's laughing so hard. And then, you know, you think, now that is really, because he wants to win this match. And then he stands up and serves an ace. It's like his chemistry was just right there. And he could have gotten upset. He could have like looked at the chair umpire and said, get that guy out of here. Could have been anything. I don't know. But I just think that sports should be an opportunity for learning that's priceless, because it means so much in the future of who we become as human beings.
Dr. Lehr, as we wrap up, I have a couple of maybe fun questions that I was hoping we could do rapid fire. And then there is one question that's more so a tradition here on the podcast that I have to ask as we conclude. So for the rapid fire questions, again, these are, you know, more fun. I have to ask, you mentioned that you think Djokovic is the GOAT of tennis, and I'm curious to hear why you think that.
Well, his record is all you need to look at. I mean, he's won the most Grand Slams, the number of weeks at number one. I mean, head to head, the number of wins he has with, you know, Fed and with Rafa. I mean, it will, you know, there's no one even close now in terms of any of the newcomers that are coming up that are going to, will they ever get anywhere near close to 20 Grand Slam victories? And so I think his record, he can rest that he will be, for this foreseeable future, a very long future, known as the GOAT. And he really has devoted his entire mind, body, spirit to achieving that. And nothing, no stone has been left unturned. I was I worked with him for 2 years in the early part of his career. I was absolutely stunned at the sacrifices he made so that he could achieve what he thought was going to be possible within him. He wanted to become the greatest player ever, and it happened.
I recently watched a 60-minute interview that he did, and in the interview, he talks about how during the changeover, he'll look up at the big, screen, and a lot of times they're showing the players, on their bench, and he'll look up to see what his opponent is doing. Do they seem fidgety? Do they seem more nervous than usual? Are they sweating more than usual? Do they seem relaxed? And he uses that as cues to understand how is my opponent feeling, and then how should I perhaps modify my game to basically combat that, or I guess even in a way try to supplement that, right? And so just hearing stuff like that, I'm sure Roger and Rafa and other players have do similar things, but just the amount of focus that he has during a match, and just hearing stories like that, it just never ceases to amaze me.
To become number one in the world in anything, you kind of have to not leave any stone unturned. Every opportunity to take an advantage, to get a little better, to get more insight into yourself, into your opponent, and into the game. And so you have to kind of have a thirst for improvement. You never can be happy with where you are. You have to always be wanting to push the envelope and be a little better tomorrow than you were today. Even though you got beat today, I want to know what I could have done. What are the things that I've got to do so that doesn't happen to me again? And it becomes almost like a magnificent obsession. You're obsessed by never, ever missing something that might lead you to a higher place in your competitive striving for being the best. And you see this with all the best players. They give up a lot. They are willing to pretty much put everything they can on the line, because that's the only way that you probably are going to emerge at the top of the mountain when so many other people are this very same obsession that you do. And you never know how talented you are or they are. All you know is the only way you're going to get there is you've got to be all in. I call it fully engaged. Every single moment of the journey has to be one of maximum engagement.
And I think that advice that you just said is valid for really anything that you undertake. I take one of my favorite things to do, you might find this funny, but it is to take advice from athletes and from individuals like yourself and try to apply it to podcasting, for instance. I mean, I try to take podcasting seriously. I try to improve every single time I record one of these things, and hopefully I am improving. But it's, that attention to detail, even what we just talked about with Novak and what other athletes are able to do and leaving no stone unturned. I think if you apply that level of detail to anything that you do, I think it could work wonders. And again, even as something as simple, people might think, hey, podcasting is easy. All you do is sit up there and ask questions and just have a conversation. But there's a lot more to it, trust me, than you might think. And certainly if you take it more seriously, you only start to realize how many different things you could optimize and what's the flow of the conversation? How is maybe my guest feeling? Do they seem engaged? Right. Same way that Novak is looking for cues on his opponent, I've been looking to Dr. Lehrer for cues to see how he might be responding to some of the questions I'm asking. So there's a lot more to it than you might think.
The more you get into this envelope, this competitive envelope, and who we are as competitors, in the chase to be the best we can be, you realize there's so much more that underlies all this. And if you're not willing to pay that price, the only caveat that I always say to athletes is that whatever you do, do not make your identity your achievement. That if you're only as good as your last achievement, you are never going to find fulfillment and happiness in life. I want you to go to the end of your life like Dan Jansen and know he put everything in it. And had he not won his gold medal in his final Olympic event, he would have been okay because it had been a gift in so many ways that prepared him for the rest of his life, and that he gave everything he could to be the best that he could be. And who the hell cares if somebody would have said, well, you went down as the greatest choker or the greatest loser in sports history. It really doesn't matter because that's not who he is, and he knows that's not who he is. But the media loves to create stories like that, that you have to be very strong or you get seduced by them.
Second question, as you look back on your career and all the athletes that you've worked with, are there any athletes in particular that you wish you would have worked with, or maybe that you saw play and you thought to yourself, if only I could help them get past this one thing?
It's a great question. I mean, I've had such such an inspiration around Michael Jordan and the ability that he had to overcome adversity and to lead and to really set a whole new path in competitive basketball. I mean, he was an elixir, and he made everyone better. And his intensity, he left no stone unturned. He was cut from his high school basketball team because they didn't think he had what it took to be a really great, high school basketball player. And that failure never went away. He never wanted to experience that again, and he never had to. So, I mean, I admire so many athletes and I've been so fortunate to work with some extraordinary athletes. But for me, it's really the backstory that I'm most interested in, and the story of who they have become as human beings, as they put everything they had, what kind of mothers or fathers are they now that they are still competitively involved, or what was the result of all this competitive success on them as a mother or father in the later part of their careers? Do they still have a great life? Are they still living in the past? There's so many things there and so I admire people like Roger Federer, who has transitioned as a father, as a husband, as a person who does so much for the good of our planet, for the African children he's building schools. And Andre Agassi, in his book Open, if people haven't read that, it's one of the greatest reads, the importance of purpose and getting your purpose right as an athlete. And it really doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with you. It has to do with the impact you can have on others in your quest to be the best you can be. So there's a lot of lessons there that took me years to learn, and I'm hoping I can create some shortcuts for others, because I never had it when I was very young. And even in the middle of my career, I didn't have the insights.
Going back really quickly to Michael Jordan, I recently had Coach Starkey on the podcast, who is the assistant head coach for the LSU women's basketball team. Yep. And he tells the story that I hadn't heard before of Jordan when they were getting off the plane. They were going to a city for one of their games, and he turns to one of his teammates, who I'm forgetting now, but he says, "Hey, I'll bet you $100, my bag is the first one to come out onto the carousel." And his teammate says, "Oh, I'll take that bet. The likelihood that, your bag out of the 50 bags here on the plane is the first one to come out, that can't be." And Jordan says, "Okay, let's do the bet." So then the teammate walks away, and Jordan goes over to the baggage handler and gives him a $20 bill. And he says, "Hey, make sure this is the first bag out on the carousel." And that story.
So he made $80.
So he made $80. And, while that story is funny, I kind of thought about it for a while, and it just goes to show how competitive he was in everything that he did. I mean, that competitive drive it didn't stop at basketball. And, listen, there's all this stuff about his gambling and I think he has a quote on there that says, "Hey, I'm not a gambler, I'm just competitive." And through stories like the one, that I just shared, you kind of see how that competitive drive, it leaked into all aspects of his life, and that, you know, that desire to win. So anyways, I figured I'd share that with you because I thought it was a pretty funny story.
It's a great story. It's a great story.
All right, Dr. Larry, two more questions here. Again, as you look back to your career, are there any particular moments that you are most proud of?
Well, I would say, I'll put it this way. The most important part of my life, by far, are my three sons. And my youngest son played professional tennis. And I traveled with him and, you know, I was a father as well as a coach. And I would say the most important part of my life has been the way in which I have tried to balance being totally devoted to my career and also getting my priorities straight with my three sons. I would say that's a big challenge for all of us, that when we're driven to achieve something and we want something to be big happening on our career front. For me, the thing that when I look at my purpose is to basically live what I teach. And that if I don't teach others, if I don't live what I teach in my own life, then what I am all about is really false. And so I want to, the acid test for me is whether or not I do what I ask other people to do. And I don't always live up to that, but that is my quest. That is my, that's the ultimate competitor for me, is myself.
Last question to round us out here. I asked Dan this question and he had to think about it for a while. So I figured I'd might ask you the same one. If you could have a conversation, a 5-minute conversation with your past self or your future self, which one would you choose and why?
Well, I'm kind of at the end of my trail. I have my future self. I feel like I had a lot to learn. I kind of started as a pioneer in a in a discipline that really was just forming. And I always love learning new things. And so I think my past, I've made mistakes. I have gone down, you know, alleys that didn't produce what I thought they would, but I just always tried to figure out honestly and then talk about what I learned and what I didn't learn, what the mistakes were. And, but my future, all I have is, you know, whatever time I have left, I still do a lot of work with athletes. I'm on, you know, their teams all over the place. And it's, for me, it's still very challenging and very exciting. And I'm still doing a lot of writing. I have my own podcasts and things. That's what I would like to do until the end of till my trails end. But I don't really feel I'll have the same opportunities I've had. The greatest thrill I had was being able to have this Human Performance Institute with all these extraordinary athletes and performers from all over the world come and train, from a sumo wrestler from Japan, trained with us for 6 months, professional chess champions, Blue Angels precision flying teams. For me, that was the greatest thrill of my life because I could learn something every day. So my past has been my most exhilarating time. I don't know how much more I have a lot to learn, but I don't know how much more time is on that clock.
Well, hopefully a lot more, because you continue with the work that you've done and continue to do. You continue to inspire me. And, you know, I mentioned it at the start that it's an honor to sit down with you. And I, you know, this past hour and 22 minutes, I have certainly learned a lot listening to you, Dr. Lair. So I can't begin to thank you enough for your time here today, but I do have one last thing that I need to ask you, and that is for one piece of advice that you would like to leave for me and the audience here today.
Never surrender your spirit. There's always a solution. There's always a way to leverage what's happening to us to make us stronger and be an inspiration. And your life really isn't about you. It's about what you can do for others. And if you get that, everything's going to fall into place.
Fantastic. Where can people find you and find some more of your work?
So my website is jim-lehrer.com. I do a lot of stuff. A lot of my videos and everything else is on LinkedIn under my name, L-O-E-H-R, Jim. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast. And I hope our listeners got something out of it. But I've enjoyed our conversation. And I would say you're very good at what you do. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. I appreciate the kind words. Dr. Lehrer, this has been an honor. I thank you again, and hopefully we'll talk again real soon.
Thank you. All the best.